Content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward for the North Carolina Reading Service. And this is the Week Magazine. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from the July 10th, July 17th issue of the Week. We are in one of those double issues, July 10th, July 17th, where our friends at the Week take a week off. And so we'll get two shows out of this magazine, and we'll be back with a new one in a couple of weeks. The cover drawing today shows White House advisor Stephen Miller. He's in the foreground in a blue suit, red tie. He's got his left fist clenched, and his right hand, he's kind of pointing a thumb back over his shoulder. He's got a little smirk on his face. In the background, we see a big airplane, and going up the steps to get on the plane are a big crowd of brown people. And the headline is Haitian Exodus, How the Supreme Court is Enabling Miller's Anti-Immigrant Agenda. That is our first main story, and I think we'll read both the main stories today. Supreme Court hands Trump key immigration wins. What happened? The Supreme Court this week struck down President Trump's attempt to radically curtail birthright citizenship, a policy pursued by Trump for more than a decade, but greenlit other major elements of his hardline immigration agenda. In a 6-3 vote, the court ruled against an executive order signed by Trump on the first day of his second term, which declared that future children born in the U.S. to undocumented migrants and most visa holders would not be considered citizens. Conservative Justices John Roberts and Amy Coney Barrett joined the court's three liberals in declaring that the order violates the 14th Amendment, ratified in 1868, which grants citizenship to nearly all children born on U.S. soil. Justice Brett Kavanaugh said the order was constitutional, but violated federal law. In a 91-page dissent, Justice Clarence Thomas said the 14th Amendment was intended only to grant equal rights to freed slaves. Justice Samuel Alito called the ruling a mistake that will seriously affect the country's future. Days earlier, the court ruled the administration could strip temporary protected status from more than 350,000 Haitians and 6,100 Syrians, setting the stage for mass deportations. That status lets migrants live and work in the U.S. if their home countries are deemed unsafe due to war or natural disasters. The administration tried to end TPS for both groups last year, drawing lawsuits that argued it had not followed proper procedures and was motivated by racial animus. In a 6-3 vote, the conservative majority said the TPS statute bars courts from reviewing the administration's actions on the discrimination issue. Alito wrote there was insufficient reason to believe Trump, who has said Haitian migrants are poisoning the blood of the U.S., was driven by racism. The ruling sowed panic among Haitians and Syrians in the U.S. Many people deported to gang violence wrecked Haiti are going to needlessly die, said Jeff Pipoli, an attorney for the Haitian plaintiffs. Republican Ohio Governor Mike DeWine urged the Trump administration to reconsider, saying his state would lose valuable workers in manufacturing and especially health care. White House aide Stephen Miller, the architect of Trump's immigration crackdown, dismissed such concerns, saying if he had a loved one in the hospital, he'd want a licensed American nurse, not the illegal alien from Haiti. What the editorial said. The birthright decision was a welcome, necessary defeat for Trump, said the South Florida Sun Sentinel, but the court could have reached no other logical result. The 14th Amendment is crystal clear. All persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof are U.S. citizens. But that win doesn't ease the human tragedy of the TPS decision, which will allow a president driven by seething racial bigotry to uproot people who've worked and raised families here, forcing them back to places the State Department deems unsafe. We oppose ejecting immigrants who have put down roots and contribute to the country, says the Wall Street Journal. But this was an open and shut case. The TPS law Congress passed in 1990 says there will be no judicial review of the administration's determination of whether a country's citizens qualify for the program, even if there are procedural errors. Justices' job is to interpret the law as written, not impose their policy preferences. What the columnist said. Haitian communities from Florida to Ohio are bracing for what comes next, said Maria Sachetti and Lauren Kaori Gurley in the Washington Post. Distraught immigrants began making plans to sell or rent their homes, secure bank accounts, and figure out thorny issues like child custody arrangements. Factory and nursing home owners steeled for the loss of key workers, and longtime residents reeled at the thought of being forced back to conflict-ridden homelands they barely know. "It's the sickest and most evil thing somebody could do," said Harlane, a 38-year-old Florida nurse who left Haiti at age 7. "It's also rank racism," said Adam Serwer in The Atlantic. "And it's astounding Alito would claim otherwise." Administration officials have made no secret of their desire to purge the United States of non-white immigrants. In her forceful dissent, Justice Elena Kagan cited Trump's own words that immigrants have bad genes, that Haitians all have AIDS and eat household pets, that America doesn't take in enough people from Norway and Sweden. All this damning evidence was presented to the court, yet the right-wing majority shrugged it off. While he's faced the occasional setback, Trump is winning the immigration war, said Adrian Carrasquillo in The Bulwark. In a second ruling last week, the court ruled that the administration can block asylum applications from outside the U.S., further limiting the ways people fleeing violence and repression can enter the country. And now it has license to take away in an instant the legal status of 1.3 million people living under TPS, all of whom followed the rules to get here. The birthright decision was a relief, said Mark Joseph Stern in Slate, but the fact that the ruling was 5-4 and not 9-0 is nothing short of stunning. To judge Trump's order unconstitutional is the only remotely plausible reading of the 14th Amendment and its historical record. Yet four justices ruled otherwise. That shocking development should upend all expectations that this court can be trusted to protect the most basic constitutional guarantees. If Trump came within a single vote of rolling back a constitutional amendment, then everything is on the table. And we will go into a second main story. It's actually tied together. The first main story was Supreme Court hands Trump key immigration wins, ... and gives him power over independent agencies, which is the second story. What happened? Overturning a 91-year precedent, the Supreme Court this week handed President Trump sweeping authority to control previously independent agencies, all except the Federal Reserve. In Trump versus Slaughter, the six conservative justices ruled that Trump was empowered to fire Rebecca Slaughter, Federal Trade Commissioner, last year because her views didn't align with the White House's agenda. The decision guts the precedent set by the 1935 Humphreys Executor decision, which held that Congress could limit the president's ability to remove certain federal agency officials without cause. Writing for the majority, Chief Justice John Roberts argued that because the FTC unquestionably exercises executive power, it must therefore be controlled by the chief executive. In a scathing dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said the ruling gave the president power unknown even to the English crown, against which the founders revolted, elevating him above his once co-equal branches by transforming a duty to take care that the laws be faithfully executed into a license to act in defiance of those very laws. In a separate case, though, the court made the Federal Reserve exempt from that new presidential power. Roberts and Justice Brett Kavanaugh joined the three liberal justices in Trump versus Cook to rule that Trump overreached when he tried to fire Lisa Cook, a Fed governor, after accusing her of mortgage fraud. Roberts wrote that the Fed was different from other federal agencies because it was uniquely structured to maintain independence, and that the president must present legitimate cause before removing a Fed governor. Trump said he would begin that process immediately so he could proceed with ousting Cook. Justice Amy Coney Barrett, meanwhile, was skeptical of the Fed carve-out. The court's holding is in serious tension with Trump versus Slaughter, she wrote in her dissent. Might history sanction other exceptions, too? What the columnist said. The Roberts court just took a wrecking ball to the separation of powers with Slaughter, said Alexis Romero in Slate. Now, not just the FTC, but dozens of other federal agencies designed by Congress to be insulated from partisan politics are fully under Trump's thumb. You can bet a newly empowered Trump will begin to make Nixon's Saturday Night Massacre look like a normal weekday. He's now free to retaliate against any agency leader who dares to investigate him for a violation of the law, refuses to attack his political rivals, or pushes back against attempts to manipulate elections. This is the world the Supreme Court has created. The ruling invites presidential abuse, said Victoria Norse in The Economist. Trump can now pressure leaders at the SEC or National Labor Relations Board to ignore wrongdoing by his cronies. He can lean on the National Transportation Safety Board or the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to waive safety requirements for his friends' companies. At the Federal Election Commission, he could replace commissioners with loyalists who deny that he lost the 2020 election. He may not even need to fire people. Just the threat may be enough. Yet it may be premature to declare the death of agencies' independence, said Ilya Somin in Reason. That's because Slaughter and Cook, as Barrett noted, appear completely incompatible. Sure, central bank independence is a long-standing tradition, but the same is true of many other independent agencies. More exceptions could follow. The two rulings are at odds because Slaughter is good law and good policy, said National Review in an editorial, and Cook is a mess. If the president controls the executive branch and doesn't control the Fed, then what is the Fed? It's not a legislature and it's not a court. The Constitution doesn't mention a fourth branch, but now we have one. It's no surprise Roberts and Kavanaugh are willing to shield the Fed, but not the other agencies, said Ellie Mistel in The Nation. They didn't feel like crashing the global economy and tanking their 401ks. Most federal agencies are there to protect the little guy the justices don't care about. The FTC goes to bat for consumers, the NLRB for employees. The Fed, though, protects the monetary policy that capitalists rely on to make their billions. The conservative justices are unruffled by this obvious double standard, said Zach Bocamp and Fox. They consistently rule that their own policy preferences are constitutionally mandated, while those they disagree with get extra scrutiny. The result is that the president has an electoral dictatorship in areas where the justices agree with him. Everywhere else, The court sets policy. Controversy of the week. Democrats, will socialists take over the party? So it isn't just a New York thing, said Eliza Collins in the Wall Street Journal. This weekend in Colorado, Milot Quiros, a 29-year-old member of the Democratic Socialist of America, the DSA, defeated 15-term incumbent Representative Diana DeGette, 68, in a Democratic primary to represent the deep blue Denver area. The win by Quiros, who most recently worked as a barista while studying for a PhD, is the latest advance for a socialist groundswell that is forcing a reckoning for Democrats. DSA candidates swept primary races in New York City last week, and insurgent leftists are now eyeing wins in the upcoming Michigan Senate primary, where progressive Abdul El Said leads the polls, and the Wisconsin gubernatorial primary. The Democratic establishment fears this Tea Party-like rebellion could cost them the midterms, because DSA policies, rent freezes, abolishing ICE, ending U.S. aid to Israel, could repel moderates in November. For now, centrist Democrats are talking tough, said Andrew Howard in Politico. House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries has downplayed the significance of a handful of primaries, while 15 moderate House Democrats and candidates signed a letter reaffirming their commitment to growth, competition, and broad prosperity. But in private, they're freaking out that the left's winning streak is potentially just starting. Republicans can't believe their luck, said Jonah Goldberg in the Dispatch. They've long caricatured Democrats as anti-American communists, but in a truly crazy figure like Daria Lisa Avila Chevalier, one of New York's DSA heirs now headed to Congress, they've been gifted that caricature made flesh. Avila Chevalier has denounced relationships between minority men and ugly white colonizer women, attended a pro-Hamas rally the day after Palestinian terrorists massacred Israeli civilians on October 7, 2023, and wants to abolish prisons, preferring to send murderers back to their community. Quiros is similarly extreme. She refuses to describe last year's deadly firebomb attack on pro-Israel protesters in Boulder, Colorado, as anti-Semitic. To call the DSA a hate group is not hyperbole, said Noah Rothman in National Review. And while its venom is right now focused on Jews or Zionist in members' preferred euphemism, ultimately what it hates is America. Focusing on the DSA misses what's really going on with Democrats, said Nia Malika Henderson in Bloomberg. Yes, the party's voters are fed up with its graying leaders, whom they blame for not blocking Trump's second-term agenda, but that doesn't mean they want socialism. Voters' overriding hunger is for young, authentic anti-candidates willing to fight Trump head-on. In progressive areas like New York City, that translates to wins for the DSA. But in deep red states, voters rejected a progressive and chose young, moderate James Tallarico as their Senate candidate. The DSA's rise shows Democrats need to embrace a bolder, less cautious approach to politics, not necessarily move further left. Voters aren't electing socialists because they dislike President Trump, said Harold Meyerson in Prospect. They're electing socialists because working Americans are being ground down by the cost of gas, housing, and health care, and because they're tired of watching the barons of Silicon Valley game politics to expand their fortunes and lower their tax bills. Democrats shouldn't embrace every radical policy of every DSA firebrand. But you'd think a party that's been fretting for a decade about how to win back the votes of working people would recognize the DSA's rise as a sign of what needs to happen for Democrats to return to power and hold it. Here's our Good Week, Bad Week piece. It's a good week for President Trump, who made at least $2.2 billion from various businesses and ventures during his first year back in office, including at least $1.4 billion from his family's meme stock and cryptocurrency operations, according to a new filing. A White House spokesperson said Trump only acts in the best interest of the American public and has no conflict of interest. It's a good week for big tents after the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service finalized a new regulatory definition of shellfish that omits the phrase having a shell. Henceforth, such non-fish seafood as squid, octopus, and cuttlefish will now be considered shellfish, despite not having external shells. It's a good week for dads. After Russia built a state-of-the-art missile defense complex near Inopraktika Foundation, a Moscow research institute headed by Katerina Tikhonova, Vladimir Putin's daughter, to help protect against Ukraine's near-daily drone strikes on the city. But it was a bad week for the great outdoors after a man fell into a vault toilet at a California campground while trying to retrieve a pair of dropped sunglasses and spent 15 minutes submerged in sewage. If you drop something inside, consider it a loss, advised the Fresno County Sheriff's Office. It was a bad week for stormtroopers after the District of Columbia agreed to pay $50,000 to an anti-Trump protester who was detained for following a National Guard patrol in the city while blaring Darth Vader's The Imperial March theme from Star Wars on his smartphone. This settlement is a reminder that our freedoms are worth fighting for, said the demonstrator, Sam O'Hara. Finally, it was a bad week for NPR, which reported, then quickly retracted, that Supreme Court Justice Samuel Alito, 76, had announced his retirement. Veteran NPR legal correspondent Nina Totenberg, 82, blamed her rookie mistake on a misunderstanding and wrote Alito that she was so, so sorry. And in other news, Supreme Court rejects Trump's appeal of sexual abuse case. E. Jean Carroll this week asked a federal judge to order President Trump to pay a $5.8 million civil judgment to her, a day after the Supreme Court declined Trump's request to overturn a jury verdict that he sexually abused and then defamed the writer. Carroll sued Trump in 2022, accusing him of assaulting her in a Manhattan department store in the 1990s, and then defaming her by calling the accusation a hoax and a lie. A jury ruled in Carroll's favor and ordered Trump to pay $5 million in damages. Her lawyer said Trump's refusal to pay up means he now also owes $800,000 in interest. A separate jury in 2024 ordered Trump to pay Carroll more than $83 million in damages for defamation. He has yet to pay that sum. After the Supreme Court refused to weigh in on the first case, Trump posted on social media that he had never met Carroll and that he was a victim of weaponization and lawfare. And we'll spend some time today with the short pieces from the two features called The U.S. at a Glance and The World at a Glance. So starting with the U.S. at a glance, we have something from Mesa County, Colorado. Deadly fires. Raging wildfires along the Colorado-Utah border last week killed three firefighters as strong winds and high heat brewed perilous conditions across the West. The federal firefighters, Emily Barker, 38, Nick Hutcherson, 27, Sydney Watson, 27, were part of a specialized team trained to go into remote areas by helicopter and to quickly put out new and rapidly escalating fires. The crew attempted to use tent-like emergency shelters to protect themselves from the Knowles Fire in Mesa County, Colorado, but were overcome. Watson worked for the U.S. Wildland Fire Service, a federal unit established as part of a Trump administration effort to suppress all fires, regardless of their locations or risk. Barker and Hutcherson were assigned to the Forest Service. 79 fires are raging in 10 states this week, and record low snowfall last winter has put over 75% of the West in drought. Traverse City, Michigan. Buttigieg swatted. Pete Buttigieg and his husband were separated from their four-year-old twins for 24 hours after being falsely accused of being a danger to their children, a swatting hoax that authorities say was politically motivated. In a Substack post, the former transportation secretary wrote that Children's Protective Services showed up to the family's house in Michigan after receiving an anonymous call from someone claiming to have spoken to a woman who claimed to have met me at a conference in Alabama, where she said I told her that I had committed unspeakable violent crimes. Buttigieg said that authorities required the children to sit alone for interviews and stay with their grandparents. I've been through political attacks in office, death threats in public life, and rocket attacks in war. But this is the ugliest thing that has happened to me since my career in service began, wrote Buttigieg, adding that he would press charges if the caller could be identified. Austin, Bibles and Schools. Overriding concerns from parents, religious leaders, and First Amendment watchdogs, the Republican-controlled Texas Board of Education last week approved a sweeping list of books every public school in Texas will be required to teach students, including numerous excerpts from the King James Bible. Alongside classical texts like William Shakespeare's Hamlet, Dante's Inferno, the list requires that students be taught Christian stories at multiple grade levels, including a picture book version of David and Goliath for elementary students, and selections from the Book of Matthew for middle schoolers, and from the Book of Genesis for high schoolers. The list is a highly unusual effort to mandate what students will read at the state level rather than by school or individual teacher. It was approved amid a broader push to bring Christianity into public schools in Texas, which last year became the largest state to require that classrooms display the Ten Commandments. The new curriculum will take effect in 2030. Washington, D.C. SCOTUS decisions. The Supreme Court sided with Vice President J.D. Vance and other Republicans who wanted to loosen campaign finance laws, potentially undercutting one of the Democrats' financial advantages for the November midterms. The court voted 6-3 to lift Watergate-era federal spending limits on how much money political parties can spend in coordination with candidates, arguing that they violated freedom of speech. The ruling is likely to shrink an advantage that Democrats have in a crucial area, broadcast advertising time. Under the current law, candidates get far lower rates on TV ads than other groups. Democratic candidates have often raised more money than Republicans, enabling them to buy more ads. But right-leaning political groups have over $125 million more than their Democratic counterparts this year, which can now be deployed in coordination with candidates to fill the airwaves. The High Court also upheld state laws that ban transgender athletes from women's and girls' sports, delivering a blow to LGBTQ+ rights. They ruled 6-3 along ideological lines that Separating teams based on biological sex doesn't violate the Constitution's guarantee of equal protection. The liberal justices partially dissented but agreed that bans don't violate Title IX, which bars sex discrimination in education. The decision will affect transgender athletes nationwide, with bans now in place in 27 states. But not every decision went Republicans' way. The justices voted against President Trump in a decision upholding a Mississippi law allowing mail-in ballots to be counted if received up to 5 days after Election Day. Trump has claimed without evidence that fraudulent mail ballots cost him the 2020 election, and he wants to ban the practice. Chief Justice John Roberts and Justice Amy Coney Barrett sided with the three liberal justices to allow over a dozen states to maintain their post-election grace periods for mail-in ballots. The defining element of an election, wrote Barrett, has always been the electorate's choice of candidate. And the world at a glance. Caracas. Millions in need. Rescue teams struggled through neighborhoods of flattened buildings this week trying to bring aid to survivors of the calamitous back-to-back earthquakes that rocked Venezuela. The official death toll from the magnitude 7.2 and 7.5 quakes stood around 2,000. But with tens of thousands of people missing, the true toll is likely at least 20,000. Believed to be among the dead were most of the 146 Venezuelans recently deported from the U.S., who were inside a state-run holding facility that collapsed when the earthquake struck. Satellite images show a huge swath of devastation, many miles wide, where roads, power lines, and sewage systems have been destroyed. Thousands of Venezuelans were in mourning. Jenny Mosquera, 44, lost her husband and daughter when her home collapsed. "I saw a slab of plaster falling from the wall onto them," she told the New Humanitarian. "I don't even have the breath left to cry." In La Guaira, the hardest hit region, locals said the response from Venezuela's U.S.-backed government was slow and inadequate. Delcy Rodriguez, installed as president after the U.S. military deposed strongman leader Nicolas Maduro in January, did not immediately deploy the military to supply generators and water or even assist in finding survivors. The U.S. has committed $300 million and 900 troops, and other countries sent aid. But more than 6 million people require assistance, including first aid, shelter, food, and water. Experts fear a sanitation crisis is brewing that could spread cholera and typhoid. "The water distribution system collapsed," said Susana Arroyo of the International Federation of Red Cross and the Red Crescent Societies. "The end of the search and rescue phase is not the end of the disaster. It's just the beginning." Mexico City. Cooperating with the U.S. In defiance of President Claudia Sheinbaum, Mexican officials have begun quietly cooperating with U.S. investigations into government collusion with cartels, the New York Times reported last week. At least a dozen high-ranking officials, many from Sheinbaum's left-wing Morena party, have offered information on other politicians. Sheinbaum says the probes amount to foreign interference in Mexican affairs, but after the U.S. in April charged 10 Mexican officials, including Sinaloa Governor Ruben Roca Moya, with helping the Sinaloa cartel move drugs into the U.S., other governors and mayors began to fear that the DEA might target them next. "They are talking to U.S. officials out of a desire to save their own skin," said Carlos Bravo Regidor, a Mexican political analyst. Ottawa. Fixing a national disgrace. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney last week announced a national design competition to restore the official prime ministerial residence, a decaying stone mansion in Ottawa that hasn't been habitable since 2015. That was the year the newly elected Justin Trudeau took a look at the home's mold, asbestos, rodent infestation, and lack of fire safety measures, and decided not to move his family in. I will never, in any event, live at 24 Sussex Drive, Carney said. But future prime ministers will undoubtedly need to raise their children here as they lead our country. So we'll restore it so they may do so safely and securely. Restoring the building, built in 1868, will cost an estimated $35 million to be raised from donors. Prague, record heat. Central European countries shattered temperature records this week as a heat dome moved slowly eastward after killing more than 1,000 people in France and 800 in Spain. The mercury soared to 107.4 degrees Fahrenheit in the Czech Republic, while Germany and Poland set new records over 104. Tram and train tracks buckled in cities across the region, and authorities told people to stay indoors if it was bearable and to come to cooling centers if it was not. In France, which experienced the worst of the heat last week, most of the fatalities were among people over 65. European homes, workplaces, and schools were not built for these temperatures, said WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus. Moscow. Fuel shortages. Ukrainian drone strikes on Russian oil facilities have caused such widespread fuel shortages in Russia that President Vladimir Putin was forced to acknowledge the crisis this week. Putin said the deficit was temporary and that damaged facilities would be restored quite quickly. Russian social media was full of videos of long lines at gas stations and even fistfights breaking out. In some cities, you have to spend half a day looking for fuel, Maxim Katz, a Russian opposition figure, told Fox News, and then they give you only a little, and you have to get back in line again. Ukrainian drones have hit oil and gas refineries and storage sites hundreds of miles into Russian territory, and some companies have had to suspend operations. Kolkata, India. Muslims expelled. Indian border guards in West Bengal state have been forcing thousands of Muslims of Bangladeshi origin across the Bangladesh border at night, the Financial Times reported this week. They open the gates on the Indian fence and push people into the darkness, said Mohammed Ashraf Usman Siddiqui, Director General of the Border Guard Bangladesh. There are women, there are children, and these poor people get stranded. The expulsions began after Bharatiya Janata Party, the Hindu Nationalist Party of Prime Minister Narendra Modi, won West Bengal state elections last month. Authorities said some 10,000 illegal immigrants, mostly Rohingya or Bangladeshi Muslims, have been expelled, while another 1,800 await deportation in holding centers. Human rights groups say many of those expelled have lived in India for decades, and some were born there. Last year, neighboring Assam state, also BJP ruled, deported hundreds of Muslims who were Indian citizens, and Bangladesh sent them back. Johannesburg, foreigners out. Tens of thousands of protesters marched through South African cities this week, demanding the expulsion of migrants from elsewhere in Africa. Shops in Johannesburg, Durban, and elsewhere were closed as foreign workers stayed home for fear of riots. Many landlords simply evicted their foreign tenants in hopes of staving off vandalism. While most of the demonstrations were peaceful, police reported scattered violence and looting. Xenophobia has soared in South Africa in recent years as immigrants, many of them from Zimbabwe and Mozambique, faced blame for a 30% unemployment rate. Jacinta Ngobese Zuma, the leader of anti-migrant group March in March, urged the government to go building to building seeking migrants. We want undocumented immigrants to be returned, she said, so that limited resources benefit poor and vulnerable South Africans. Got a couple of the obituaries for you. Interestingly, neither of them are what I would call household names, but as you'll see, they've been very influential on popular culture. The director who made our favorite sitcoms, James Burrows, 1940 to 2026. James Burrows' name was easy to miss, but his work was inescapable. The prolific director helmed many of America's most beloved sitcoms and co-created Cheers, directing most of its episodes as well as every episode of Will and Grace. As a frequent Friends and Frasier director, he dominated NBC's must-see TV lineup in the 1990s. His resume spanned from The Bob Newhart Show and Laverne and Shirley in the 1970s, to Taxi in the 1980s, to 2000s hits like The Big Bang Theory and Two and a Half Men. Over that career, the Spielberg of sitcoms got an astounding 48 Emmy nominations and won 11, five for directing and six for producing. My mind is never a blank, he said. If something isn't funny, I'll try nine ways to make it funny. I won't just quit on it. Burroughs was the son of a Broadway composer, Abe Burroughs, and he grew up in New York City in the New York theater scene. He sang in the Metropolitan Opera Children's Chorus until his voice changed, then went to the High School of Music and Art. While attending Yale University's graduate acting program, Burroughs took a required directing class and got hooked, said the Washington Post. His family connections helped. He started out as a dialogue coach for a short-lived ABC show his father directed, and later, while working on the Broadway show Holly Go Lightly, also directed by his dad, he met Mary Tyler Moore. When he saw her Mary Tyler Moore show on TV in 1974, he reached out asking for work, and she invited him to direct. That break led him to more TV jobs, where he met Glenn and Les Charles, his future Cheers co-creators. While Burroughs wasn't credited as a primary writer, he contributed the best gags and was the creative force behind Cheers, said The Times, shaping its wry humor. He had an instinctive feel for what makes an audience laugh. Beloved by actors, Burroughs could coax hilarious line deliveries out of even unseasoned performers such as the Friends cast, who saw him as a father figure. He extended that same mentoring to a generation of Helmers now running their own shows, said Variety. But it's his shows that have lasted. He directed more than 75 pilots that got picked up for series. Almost any night you can turn on your television or go online and find a show that I directed, he said in 2022. I'm very proud of that. The music mogul who had a golden ear. Clive Davis, 1932 to 2026. Clive Davis didn't fit in at the Monterey International Pop Festival, the kickoff to the 1967 Summer of Love. In his khakis and tennis sweater, he was an obvious square among the hippies smoking and swaying as artists like Jimi Hendrix and the Grateful Dead took the stage. Yet the newly minted president of Columbia Records recognized that music was about to change forever when he watched a wild new singer deliver her explosive soulful rendition of Ball and Chain. Though his label specialized in jazz, classical, and Broadway, the enraptured Davis rushed to sign Janis Joplin, politely declining her suggestion that they cement the deal with a role in the hay. The man who had become famous for finding rock and pop's greatest talents had made his first major discovery. "I realized this was going to be the future," said Davis. "I could feel it in my bones." Davis never intended to lead a life in music, said CNN.com. The son of an electrician, Clive J. Davis was raised in Brooklyn's Crown Heights, studied political science at New York University, and received a full scholarship to Harvard Law. Hired by Columbia Records as a lawyer in 1960, a series of reorganizations saw him appointed to the label's top job. Davis soon demonstrated an almost supernatural gift for talent spotting, said The Guardian. In the years after Monterey, he brought the label a dazzling array of hitmakers, including Bruce Springsteen, Billy Joel, and Neil Diamond. His career was briefly derailed by the Drugola scandal in the early 1970s, when federal investigators accused record execs of bribing DJs with drugs to get airplay. While Davis was never charged, the financial investigation turned up a failure to pay taxes on $8,800 worth of vacation expenses, and Columbia fired him. But Davis landed on his feet, said the New York Times, taking over the failing Bell record label and rechristening it Arista. He quickly scored a number one hit with Barry Manilow's Mandy. Soon he'd built a roster that included Patti Smith and the Kinks and oversaw career revivals for soul legends Aretha Franklin and Dionne Warwick. In 1983, he signed 19-year-old Whitney Houston, turning her eponymous debut into one of the most successful albums in music history. In later years, Davis worked with talent such as Alicia Keys and Kelly Clarkson, and remained active in the music industry until his death, throwing a legendary annual Grammys party. "It remains exciting," he said in 2013. "I'm still looking for the next thing, the next artist." We'll pick up a couple of the business columns this week. Energy. Can renewables survive Trump? The war in Iran has delivered a huge boost for renewable energy around the world, said Paul Krugman in his Substack newsletter, except in the United States. With Americans suffering from soaring electricity prices thanks to data centers and high gasoline prices, you'd think the White House would be open to generating as much energy from as many sources as possible, but it's not. Earlier this month, the Trump administration announced it would pay the energy developer Invenergy $765 million not to develop 4 wind farms off the coast of New York, California, and Maine. Because of Trump's bizarre loathing of green energy, his administration has in total committed $2.5 billion in taxpayer dollars to destroy already approved cost-effective clean energy projects. Trump officials dream of a world powered by U.S. oil and natural gas, but that's not going to happen because the Iran war has reminded the world that relying on imported fossil fuels is a major economic and security risk. Trump doesn't hate all clean energy sources, said Liam Denning in Bloomberg. In fact, he seems to be all in on carbon-free nuclear. The race to win in artificial intelligence is in large part a race to find enough electricity to feed it, and Trump is committed to reigniting the U.S. nuclear sector. His interest may be driven by marked envy of China, where almost half the world's new nuclear capacity is under construction, at far cheaper costs than in the U.S., thanks to years of sustained industrial policy and subsidies. Meanwhile, solar is booming, said Thor Benson in Rolling Stone, despite Trump calling it the scam of the century and making moves to hinder its growth. New residential solar panels were installed in the U.S. every 59 seconds last year, according to the Solar Energy Industries Association, and around 6 million American homes now have them. Energy from the sun is starting to outperform coal, and the cost of building out solar farms continues to decrease in price as the panels themselves become more effective at capturing energy. For an example of a cleaner, more resilient, and more cost-efficient grid, look to Texas, said Rahm Emanuel in the Wall Street Journal. The state has diversified its energy portfolio and created a more resilient transmission system years ago, and it has paid off. Wind and solar now supply about 40% of Texas electricity, while its leadership in battery storage has helped the state keep power prices 10 to 30% below the national average. America needs to supersize this. Presidents seem to believe the White House should get to decide which forms of energy America is allowed to pursue, said Christopher Barnard in National Review. Former President Joe Biden paused approvals for liquefied natural gas projects and canceled the Keystone XL pipeline. Trump has committed similar mistakes with his resistance to renewable energy, but picking winners and losers based on political preferences isn't going to get us anywhere. Energy infrastructure projects require huge upfront investments and have exceptionally long timelines. When permitting policy shifts dramatically with each administration, investors pull back, projects stall, costs rise, and the result is absolute paralysis. The nation needs more clarity to meet this era of extraordinary energy demand. And we'll pick up one of the Talking Points articles. America at 250. Trump's fair is a flop. It's almost as if the last 250 years never happened, said Stephen Collinson in CNN.com. President Trump last week kicked off the Great American State Fair on the National Mall. Billed as a modern-day World's Fair to celebrate the nation's semi-quincentennial, with a speech that implied the nation's greatness at this landmark moment was largely thanks to him. Rather than ruminate on America's journey and founding promise, Trump proclaimed that, like those patriots of 1776, he also had saved our country in all things following the total disaster of the Biden administration. The president wasn't supposed to be the event's headliner. He took over as the main act last month after artists including Martina McBride and the Commodores pulled out of an opening concert, having discovered the supposedly nonpartisan event was organized by Trump allies. In the end, more than 1,000 MAGA fans gathered to watch Trump run through his list of boasts and grievances, but he later claimed at least 45,000 people were there. The fair itself was bleaker than I expected, said Kate Corliss in Washington. Trump insists the event is packed with happy people, but the crowd was sparse when I visited, which is understandable given the lackluster attractions. Some attendees took photos in front of a scaled-down plywood replica of Trump's planned victory arch. Others waited to ride a 110-foot Ferris wheel that kept breaking down. Then there were the cramped, mausoleum-like tents that housed exhibits on all 56 states and territories. In the Nebraska tent, I learned the state invented modern center pivot irrigation and a booth for Trump's Truth Social platform. It didn't have to be like this, said Michelle Cottle in the New York Times. A decade ago, Congress established America 250 to plan bipartisan celebrations for the nation's birthday. But it was shoved aside to make way for Freedom 250, the Trump-led group that organized this farce and rerouted tens of millions of dollars toward a politicized spectacle. Yes, the fair is a fiasco, but I love it, said Rex Hupke in USA Today. I love watching Fox News broadcast from the event, its hosts claiming the place is filled with excited patriots, while the scenes behind them show a vast expanse of untrod-upon grass. It's a daily humiliation for a president who craves validation. For the past 17 months, Trump has subjected Americans to the kind of bullying that pushed the founding fathers toward revolution. to experience a sense of delight and quiet satisfaction as this vain bully's big party fizzles is as American as both apple pie and real state fairs. And a few of the short notes. Nearly 4 million Americans who signed up for Affordable Care Act plans dropped their coverage this year after the loss of enhanced subsidies caused premiums to soar. An estimated 19.2 million people were enrolled in ACA plans as of February, down from the 23 million who'd taken out coverage at the end of open enrollment. Recruitment drive is underway at the Supreme Court to more than double the roughly 200 officer security force that guards the justices and protects the court's building. The court, which has faced a substantial increase in threats, requested $210.3 million in security funding for fiscal 2027, a 114% increase over 5 years. On the poll watch, 44% of adults are extremely or very proud of America's history, down from 58% during President Trump's first term in 2017. 47% are not proud of how the country treats different groups in society. Only 28% are extremely or very proud of how U.S. democracy works. And we'll finish with a quote from Mark Twain, who says, "It ain't what we don't know that gets us into trouble. It's what we know for sure that just ain't so." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of The Week Magazine. Hope you've enjoyed it. Please join us again next time. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Week Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have questions or comments, please give us a call at 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. And as always, thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.